Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis, your host of Podcast UFO. Today is episode 6 with Dr. Lynn Kitai, and we are discussing the Phoenix Lights. This podcast is being released on March 13th, 2012, which is the 15th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights mass sighting. Please follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/podcastUFO. You can listen to us on Stitcher. We have a free app available on our website, which is podcastufo.com. We have some great upcoming guests, and you can check that out. You can also interact with them. If you go to our website, on the top menu bar, you can click on Interact. And we're still looking for some bloggers. If you're interested in doing some blogging, please contact me at info@podcastufo.com. Anyway, I hope you enjoy today's show, and here it is. Hi, everyone. We have Dr. Lynn Kitai on the line in Phoenix, Arizona. How are you doing, Dr. Lynn?
I am doing fabulous. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, and the release, when this is coming out, is the 15th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights.
Yes, it's coming up for anybody that doesn't know about the Phoenix Lights. Actually, that's a name that was given to really the most important and most documented mass sighting in modern history, certainly in ufology, and now we're learning that it very well could be from all of history, because there were over 10,000 people throughout the state who witnessed something quite extraordinary 15 years ago on March 13th when they were looking skyward. Many were looking skyward to get a glimpse of the Hale-Bopp comet, which was very clear in the northwest sky, when they also caught a glimpse of a mile to 2 mile wide, in some very credible reports, either these orbs, these balls of light that seemed to be attached to something, but they couldn't quite see what it was attached to, or actual craft. There were many things going on, many events going on, different phenomena, as well as many hours of these phenomena. There's so much mis and disinformation out there in the media and the bunkers and so forth, but both my husband and I had a very close sighting to our home in Paradise Valley. We're pretty high in the mountains and have a panoramic view of the city skyline from our bedroom. One wall is a window, and we know what helicopters and streetlights and car lights and even flares deployed by the military occasionally look like. And these unknowns were very different from that, and we're familiar with the other natural or earthly lights out there. And we had a very close sighting to our home, and I happened to catch pictures of it. If we have time, we can get into that sighting. But wondered for 2 years, without any interest or knowledge in the topic at all, what this advanced technology, these orbs, were doing right outside our bedroom window. And didn't even know who to show the picture to, and lo and behold, they came back 2 years later, 2 months before the mass sighting. I happened to catch the second night, the same phenomena as I would also capture on video, the three endpoints of a mile-wide triangle, the three lights on the ends of a V or triangle that thousands of people had seen preceding the time I took the picture shortly before 10 o'clock, and which blew me away. I mean, now thousands of people saw what I had seen, but 2 months before, I caught the same phenomena head-on, turning into a V-shape, and it was so unnerving, not having had an explanation for the 95 sighting, that I called around the next morning, really looking for a logical explanation. Somebody else must have seen it. It was massive, and found air traffic controllers at Sky Harbor International Airport who saw the same thing at the same time. In fact, they were more excited than I was when I got on the phone with them. And what one of the air traffic controllers shared was that they saw this pop up right about 1,000 feet altitude above Class B restricted airspace, which is about a 30-mile radius around the center of the airport, which is an area, if anyone comes into that airspace, they must call the tower, and no one did. So they got alarmed, and they looked on radar, did not show up on radar, picked up their binoculars to look, and in their own words, described six points of light totally equidistant from each other, massive span, over a mile wide, that seemed to be attached to something. Again, you would hear this during the mass sighting too, but they couldn't quite see what it was attached to. Other people on March 13th, as it went right over them, would see that there was kind of a force field or something in between the lights that was blocking out the stars. But at any rate, the air traffic controllers saw this and actually turn. As I was taking my pictures, they saw it turn against the wind. And one of the air traffic controllers was a meteorologist, so he knew what he was talking about, and then move as a unit slowly behind South Mountain, which is just south of the airport. And when I asked what was it, there was silence. And then one of the air traffic controllers said, "Beats me." And I said, "You're air traffic controller. You're supposed to know it's in our airspace, and you didn't know what that was, the Class B restricted airspace." And they were stumped. I mean, they said definitely wasn't flares, nothing that they ever saw before or even knew existed. And we kept in contact. I continued photographing these things up into and including March 13th, again, when thousands of people saw what I had been seeing. And there was much going on. I have to say that there is so much mist and disinformation out there. We have reports as early as 3 p.m. in the afternoon here in the Phoenix area, and reports in New Mexico at 5:30, California at 7:15, over Las Vegas, actually covering Las Vegas, seen by a commercial airline and the whole crew and 140 passengers. And then 5:30 the next morning, when a Boeing crew was coming into work at Sky Harbor, they saw an object hovering over their tarmac. So this was going on for many, many hours, and many different things, not only orb formations, but also different craft. If anybody's near a computer and they can get on the Phoenix Lights Network website, which is www.thephoenixlights.net, and go to the GAP page, G-A-P, they'll see the Geospatial Animation Project, which will show 8 or 9 different crafts that were compiled from thousands of reports from the National UFO Reporting Center in Seattle, Washington, Village Labs, which was a clearinghouse here locally, Councilwoman Vice Mayor Frances Barwood, who, by the way, was the only elected official who even asked for an investigation, because so many of her constituents, over 1,000 constituents, had called her asking, why isn't there an investigation, which we can get to in a second, and then as well as Arizona MUFON, to show there were about 8 or 9 different craft that people described. Now, whether it was one craft that could morph into looking differently, or a parade of different craft, or the perspective from where the person was standing, we may never know. But there were multiple things happening throughout the state. In fact, these craft were so low, the objects were so low, whether they were just lights that seemed to be attached to something or actual craft that people saw. The rooftop level, that some people said they could have thrown a stone at it. It was that close. Totally silent. Totally silent. It didn't even displace the air around it. And some people actually saw it take off at a tremendous speed, blink speed. Some people saw it, as you'll see on the GAP page, actually split in two. And other people saw it just go way up to the sky really quickly. Other people saw these orbs detach from the main object, go out into the environment, and redock with it. So the technology was just so advanced, and it's just mind-boggling what people were seeing. Plus, there was a whole story behind it, how it affected people in real and long-term as well, that we can get into. But at any rate, this was for many, many hours. People were just in awe. I mean, that's the other thing that's very interesting when you look at the data on March 13th alone, because 6 months before the movie Independence Day had come out. And, you know, we are so inundated with threat, 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 and harm, harm, harm. And I have to say, first of all, that in 15 years, it's March 13th, and I'm pretty intimately involved with this investigation from day one, there has not been one, not one report of harm, threat, or abduction associated with the Phoenix Lights. If anything, it's quite the contrary. I can't speak for everything else out there, but I can say that for the Phoenix Lights, even in real time, because, as I said, Independence Day had come out 6 months before, and when kids saw it, and they were usually, children were usually the first people to see these gigantic formations of lights coming towards them, they were scared, and rightly so. I mean, if we're, you know, taught to be afraid of these things, when we see something that we're afraid of, how do you think we're going to react? And they were jumping up and down, Independence Day, Independence Day. But as the phenomena got close, I mean, they were really scared. And as the phenomenon got close, not only children, but adults as well, a calmness took over them, a connectedness to the phenomena that when it passed by, they were excited, they were thrilled, they were in awe, they were in wonder, and wanted to run after it. I mean, it's amazing just in real time how whatever this phenomenon was really connected with the witnesses and calmed them as it was happening. And certainly, after, and by the way, there were some telepathic messages to people too, not to worry, we're not here to hurt you, that kind of thing. But long term, it changed people's lives forever. I mean, I have to tell you, the transformation has been so positive, and for most people, and if they experienced it, they're still talking about it today. I get emails weekly from people that are just remembering it or saw something on TV or saw the documentary on Netflix or on Amazon.com or whatever. And it brings back, you know, a flood of memories, and they want to share that they saw it too. And that's really important, I have to say, for all unexplained phenomena. One of the reasons as a physician I came forward, because people have to know it's okay to talk about this. It's enough with the snickering and the criticism and the ostracizing and the discrediting. Most things can be explained. Most things can be explained, but there's a small percentage that cannot. And just because we don't have the technology yet to definitively define what these things are, it doesn't mean they're not real. We might just be looking on an AM dial for an FM frequency. It took us 17 centuries before the advent of the microscope to 17 centuries, that's a long time, to realize that there are zillions of microorganisms all around us, even in our bodies. Mm-hmm. Some are pathogens and some are beneficial, but we've learned to deal with it. And just as we've learned to now recognize that there are tiny organisms that we can't see with our human eyes, there's also electromagnetic energies around every living cell, gamma rays and radio waves and so forth that we can't see. Mm-hmm. But they're there. So, we don't have the technology yet to definitively define what these things are yet, but that's why it's so important to talk about it and to get the information out there, as I've tried to do, because I pushed my entire professional medical career aside for 4 years to try to find a logical source and meaning for what I had witnessed and photographed up close and personal, and I have yet to find it. If anything, it opened up an entire new world to me that ultimately I had to go back to work to help put our younger son through medical school. He's a neurologist now. But while I was chief clinical consultant at the Arizona Heart Institute Wellness and Imaging Center, I pared down the book to the best information, the 750-page journal, to the best information that I found, and did a lot of soul-searching and finally came forward in 2004 with the book, The Phoenix Lights, A Skeptic's Discovery That We Are Not Alone, and haven't looked back. Several months later, I started production on the documentary and had to make a choice, and I did. We finished the documentary, which has won over a dozen international film festival awards, which we're so proud of, and it's unheard of for a documentary, especially one of the genre. But wanted to get out something out there visually with not only the witnesses, which is very, very poignant, detailed and heartfelt descriptions, but also professors and experts that I worked with as well, and a lot more. So the information is out there if people would like to take a look at it.
That's right. I would consider this actually one of the, you know, the most major sightings ever, like you said earlier. You know, this along with Rendlesham Forest, and there's a few others that come to mind, of course, Roswell. But in modern times, I would say yes. It's kind of funny. I think of there's, you know, approximately 10,000 people see this, and then there's still so many skeptics about it. And then I believe it was a few months later, the flare thing came
out. Well, that's a really good question and a really good point. First of all, when somebody tells me, oh, they were just flares, and blows it off, you know, everybody comes from a different background, from a different upbringing, from a different belief system. Some people can't deal with this, and some people don't want to deal with it, and that's okay. Everyone in their own time. But again, the information is there if you want to learn and grow, because I giggle a little bit when somebody says, you know, oh, it was flares, it was a blimp, it was a hologram. I know that they haven't looked at the data. They haven't read my book, and right. They haven't looked at the documentary, because there is so much more to the story that confirms that something really extraordinary happened here, and it definitely wasn't flares. They may have sent off some flares somewhere, but that's not what thousands of people saw.
It must have been swamp gas, right?
Right, you got it. Well, you know, J. Allen Hynek, who actually brought that cause up when he was plucked out of the University of Northwestern University. He was the head of the astronomy department there, and they plucked him out to become the head of Project Blue Book, which was actually the only public. The official public investigation of UFOs, which closed in 1969. Now, first of all, they closed with the announcement that UFOs are not a threat to national security.
The Condon Report, or whatever it is?
Well, that's a whole other thing.
Oh, okay,
but the,
sorry.
The Project Blue Book, you know, their announcement was that UFOs are not a threat to national security. Well, how did they know that? Okay, number one, if they weren't studying it. And meanwhile, Dr. Hynek not only coined the phrase close encounters, but right before he passed, I believe it was in 1985, he not only, once the Project Blue Book closed, he formed the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago, but right before he passed, he admitted that he was told to, you know, brush off any credible UFO sightings as swamp gas or whatever, not to cause panic to the public, because we were dealing with the Cold War at the time. But he also said, which is very poignant, that science happens in threes. First, there's complete disbelief. Then there's the attitude, well, it might be so. And then the final stage is, I knew it all the time. And I think that we're getting closer and closer, because we've really been inundated with mis- and disinformation for the last 50, 60 years, and certainly since Roswell. And it's kind of settling in now, not only the reality that, well, we might not be alone, because now Kepler in and of itself is looking for habitable planets, and we know that there are now are trillions of galaxies, not just our one Milky Way galaxy, with trillions of stars and trillions of planets. I mean, the possibilities are endless for life out there, because we know that the ingredients of life are out in space, amino acids and hydrogen and nitrogen and oxygen and so forth. So, and even here on Earth, we have microorganisms and whatever that are surviving not only in the hot springs of Yellowstone and in the frozen Arctic lakes, but just last year NASA made the huge announcement that there's microbes that are living on arsenic.
Right.
And we also know that deep down in the sea, where there's no light, there's no sunlight at all, there's still organisms that are pretty amazing, if you've ever seen some of that footage. But at any rate, the bottom line is that life is viable everywhere. And, you know, to think that there isn't life out there is really putting your head in the sand, number one. And number two, when people talk about interstellar, you know, it's too far to travel and all that, I'm actually sharing new information in the latest edition of my book, which just came out this past year, that I never thought that I would ever share, because it just, I still can't wrap my head around it. But it's data, and I have to say that I've really tried to stick to the data, the scientific data, as much as possible here, because I am a scientist and I am a skeptic, so a healthy skeptic. But nonetheless, I really tried to put together something that could not be explained. I mean, the data could not be explained, and it certainly can't be denied. I've gone to extreme lengths to have my photographs, and my unique collection, I have to tell you, of these phenomena was so not only massive, but also once I went to the University of Arizona Optical Science Department, Consciousness Study Department, ASU, Arizona State University, Geology, Anthropology, Mathematics, and Astronomy Departments, as well as the renowned Brooks Institute of Photography and Navy Optical Physicist Dr. Bruce Maccabee, to have my photographs, 35-millimeter photographs, analyzed. No one could give me an answer to what they were to this day. They cannot be explained or denied. So when you have that kind of data as an educator, and what's ironic, actually, is that I am a medical doctor, but I've donated my time and money for the last 35 years for community education. I worked at NBC in Philadelphia with Jessica Savage, if anybody remembers that name, in the 70s, and then had an international syndication, grew from that, and then worked with NBC here in Phoenix in the early 80s, and then USA Cable in the mid-80s, and actually at that point, seeing kids drowning in substance abuse in the practice, formed my own company to produce video and workbook curriculums on the reality of vital health issues like AIDS and teen pregnancy and substance abuse for the classroom. Discovery Education is distributing them now as we speak. And when this fell in my lap, I have to tell you, I knew nothing about this topic. Mm-hmm. And so literally pushed my medical career aside to find a logical explanation, as I mentioned earlier. But I have yet to find it, and felt, you know, obliged once I knew that this information was so credible and so important to share it with the public and, you know, have it look back.
Right, right. Now, getting back to the debunking, what other disinformation would you say was put out there about this?
Well, you know, what was really interesting, and I guess very puzzling, it was very puzzling for the witnesses for sure, after the mass sighting, there was no investigation. There was no explanation. It was uncanny. I mean, here, these phenomena passed over at rooftop level, if anything, right over people's heads. I mean, we have credible witnesses. We have a pilot in the who was a Vietnam pilot as well as commercial pilot now, who had this phenomena go right over his head during the mass sighting, and he actually looked up into the wells. He called them canisters of light, huge canisters that had kind of swimming light in it. It was very hard to describe, like a gaseous type of a situation, like nothing that we could ever imagine existed. You know, when you have people with this kind of situation and there's no investigation, I mean, come on, it's a public safety issue, if nothing else. But anyway, when you look how the story unfolded, and that's what I was doing with my book. I mean, every day I would sit there not only meticulously trying to study this and find a logical explanation, but I was talking to the military, you know, as much as I could, and they were more curious and as curious as we were. They were more interested in looking at my data than giving an explanation for it. And as far as the witness accounts, that's another thing we can get into. But, you know, there was nothing. I mean, people went to the officials and they would say, what, something happened on March 13th? And as we found out later, some of them even saw it and didn't admit it. But that took time for them to come forward. But at any rate, June 18th, a front page USA Today article came out opening up our mass sighting to international scrutiny. I'm telling you, overnight, it was unbelievable. By the next morning, every news station, morning show was carrying the Phoenix Lights and the mass sighting. And we were deluged by media from all over the world. Overnight, it was unbelievable. And by late morning, the next day, June 19th, the former governor, Fife Sottenton, announced an unscheduled press conference that they had found the culprit, and the conference would be later that day, the culprit of the mass sighting. And everybody took it seriously, including the media. And here he comes marching out, one of his aides, with a giant alien head, and made a mockery of the whole event, which really offended many, many people. I mean, it wasn't a joke to these people, especially parents that were with children were very offended.
Because, now, did he get a lot of flack about that? That's something you never hear about.
Well, certainly the witnesses were aghast that he would do such a thing. Because, I mean, here they were out and about. Many people were looking up at the sky at the Hale-Bopp Comet when this happened, but they were also in sports teams and going to the mall, and it was just a lovely night, and they were just out and about. And this thing passes right over them, and he's making a joke of it. I mean, this massive thing that, you know, it just was unbelievable to people that he would do that. And I have to say, yes, he, personally, I don't know if he got flack, but I know that I heard about it from a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And even then, I mean, it was like, you know, what's going on here? I mean, nobody could believe that the government, and I think I mentioned earlier that Councilwoman Vice Mayor at the time, Frances Barwood, innocently at a May meeting 1 month before, because so many of her constituents had called her, and also the media contacted her to ask at the time, because they had heard about it, you know, what's going on. And she innocently asked in a council meeting, you know, maybe we should look into this. And she was plastered. I stayed anonymous for 7 years, and I was so happy that I did, because people such as herself and other witnesses that came forward, especially in the print media here, were just ostracized. It was awful. I mean, I have to tell you, it was really, really sad how initially, you know, the reaction happened. Now, the TV media was much more on top of things, I have to say. I have to give them credit for that. And when I came forward, I have to tell you, I mean, I had done, you know, health reporting in the early 80s, and a number of the people that I worked with were just starting off at the time. And when I came forward in 2004, and the chief investigators, Mike Tanner and Jim Del Toso, had named the person who was letting out all the pictures, because this wasn't about me. It was about the data, and I was happy to leave, get my pictures and video out there. They would call that person Dr. X. So when I came forward in 2004, and now these people I had known in the early 80s that were just getting started were, you know, the head of the news department or the head of production or whatever, they were amazing. I mean, they were like, "You're Dr. X. Well, come on over." And they, ever since, I have to tell you, ever since, they have been so kind and, you know, really just on top of things. And, yes, most things can be explained. Only a small percentage cannot. And we've had other sightings, and some can be explained and some can't. But they don't ridicule. You always have the aberrant, you know, anchor on set that will, you know, make a funny joke because he's not informed. And you know that he's not informed right away. But nonetheless, that does happen. But the bulk of the media here, particularly the people I know, have been so kind and really on top of things. It's been an amazing transformation in and of itself for the media here, who take this topic seriously. And that's what has to happen everywhere. I mean, this is a serious thing. This isn't a joke. You know, I've certainly gave up my whole career, medical career, after I came forward with the book, and I haven't stopped. I've been speaking worldwide just to raise awareness and to just say to people, hey, you know, the data is there, and of course it is a choice, and we have free will, but the data is there if you care to look at it and to learn and to grow, because that's what this is about. It's like enough with the ridicule and the discrediting. It's time to get this topic out in the open and address it, accept it, and study it. And science really needs to come aboard here.
I agree.
You know, and because, you know, not only to find out who's driving these things, but to move forward in our own evolution. That's why I'm sharing this new data now in the most recent edition of the book that was analyzed way back in 1998 by Navy optical physicist Dr. Bruce Maccabee, the first and the last picture of our very close sighting, which I can describe for you if we have time to do that. My husband called me to our bedroom window, and we're pretty high in the mountain in Paradise Valley, and this is a little below us, over a private, gated area, very treacherous land. There was nobody standing there doing this or anything like that. It was impossible. There were three orbs in a pyramid formation, one on top and two closely aligned underneath, just hovering there together. And, you know, coming from a video background, I thought, oh, geez, I've got to get my camera. But I didn't want to miss anything. I didn't know how long it would last. And I have to say, people say, why didn't people get more pictures on March 13th? There's only a handful of video. Well, number one, we didn't have cell phones much.
That's
and
right.
Cell phones were big. They didn't have cameras in them. And,
no cameras.
You know, who goes out to, you know, out and about with cameras in their hands, okay? And there were a few people that did to try to catch the Hale-Bopp comet, but this thing was so massive and dark, you know, blackened out the sky that the pictures didn't turn out. So anyway, getting back to this close sighting, I tried to take everything in mentally, the shape, the size, the color, and so forth. They were about 3 to 6 feet each, depending on how close or far they were. And they were pretty close. I mean, they were just yards from our home. And they were oval shaped. Each of them, there were three distinct objects, like an egg on their side. And I called them an orb because the light did not extend outside the edge. The light was self-contained. And there was a uniform amber color throughout. It didn't have like a hot spot, like a light bulb. And it didn't glare at all. That I noticed immediately. Every other light out there glared, but these didn't. They were very soothing, very mesmerizing. And as I'm looking at them, you know, in awe, I thought, if I don't get a picture of this, nobody's going to believe it. So I ran to the closet to grab my 35-millimeter Instamatic camera that I keep handy to capture sunsets. And by the way, anybody that gets on the photo page on the phoenixlights.net, Phoenix Lights Network, will see at the bottom of the photo page are a couple sunsets where there's actually a rod, giant rod or cigar-shaped object in two different pictures, two different rolls, November and December of 2000 that I did not see these objects while I was taking the pictures, but they're in the negative. So they're around, and we can get to the reason I'm sharing this new data as well. But at any rate, go to grab my camera. My husband calls me back. He says, get over here quick. One of them is disappearing. And as we watched, the top orb started to dim, but it was like mechanical, like it started to implode from the outside inwards, very, very, very slowly, getting smaller and smaller and smaller, as if there was an intelligence behind it, until it was a dot, and then it was gone. But it still felt as if it was still there. It's very hard to describe. I mean, where did it go? Did it go to another dimension? And it felt like it was still there, but we didn't see it. I went out onto the balcony, caught a quick picture of the two bottom orbs, and that's posted on the website, and immediately noticed an eerie silence as if time had stopped. It was just uncanny. And as intently as I was watching these two lower orbs, it felt as if something was watching me. I have to admit it, and I did not admit it till after the mass sighting 2 years later, but going through my mind at that moment, I was thinking, who are you? What are you? Do you know that I'm here? I'd love to meet you. And the next thing I remember, the left bottom orb started to implode as well, as just like the top one did. And I quickly shot a picture of that, and that's also posted. And that was the only picture that turned out at the time. But for me, it was spectacular because I caught the phenomena in progress. And, mm-hmm. and disappearing, and you can see right there, one's half disappeared and one's still there. But I didn't even know who to show it to. I have to tell you, I knew no one associated at all or interested in the topic. And, you know, I just wondered for 2 years what this advanced technology was doing outside our bedroom window, why my husband and I saw it together and, you know, looked out in the sky, didn't see anything similar to that until 2 months before the mass sighting. And I mentioned that earlier. I saw these orbs come back at a distance, and I guess the scientists in me just felt compelled to document them on film, and I'm really happy happy that I did. By the way, video doesn't do it justice. Anybody that's seen the video, these lights are much smaller. They flicker. They're white. And in real life, they're huge balls, actually spinning balls of energy. Maybe they're living energy themselves. In fact, the first picture that I have posted on the photo page on the Phoenix Lights Network is the topography, so people can see the view from our balcony. And as you can see, there's two mountain ranges in the distance, right beyond the airport. One is South Mountain on the left, and the other, further back, a few miles, is the Estrella Mountain Range. And in between, the basin in between, is the Gila River Indian Reservation, which is very sacred ground. Now, serendipitously, and by the way, I've come not to believe in coincidence. There are just too many coincidences, and I hope people pick up the book to read about those that are just blow you away. But at any rate, this is one of the coincidences. 6 months before the mass sighting, I was invited to present my substance abuse prevention education program to the Gila school there, which is the one school that they have on the reservation, and got a little friendly with them. They don't usually talk to outsiders, but I went to them after the mass sighting because as I looked at the data, and in science we look for repeatability, I kept seeing that these phenomenon, it's right there, the data speaks for itself, keep popping up right where South Mountain and the Estrellas intersect. And their basin, you know, in the basin is where their reservation is. So I called them up and I said, did anybody happen to see strange lights on March 13th? And they started to giggle. And I said, is that funny? And they said, are you kidding? We've been looking up at them for centuries. We call them sky people.
Wow.
Light beings. Yeah, it's part of their culture. I knew nothing about that. And what I found out, actually, once I started investigating that part of it, is that indigenous cultures worldwide believe that there are other intelligences coming to visit them. They have protocols. Even right here, the Hopi have protocols to invite these phenomena in. The Navajo, actually, we have a big event happening shortly to celebrate the 15th anniversary, and Navajo Rangers will be sharing the plethora of sightings and anomalous phenomena that are occurring on their reservation. And again, these are very sacred grounds, but the bottom line is that Native peoples have believed for centuries that there are other intelligences out there, and many of them believe that their ancestors coming to give them inspiration and comfort and messages. And in fact, there are petroglyphs, okay, drawings in the stone. And one of the drawings, which blew me away, that's right on South Mountain, is three orbs in a triangle formation.
Wow.
That really blew me away when I saw that one. But also, you know, Estrella means star in Spanish. It was named by the Spaniards because of the stories, these stories of these orbs showing up in that area. And that the Native peoples now call the Estrellas the gateway to the stars. They believe that there is a gateway or portal in that area. And if you look at my pictures, that might be true. But the reason I'm sharing now what happened with the close sighting is that inevitably, and we don't have time to go into those stories. I do hope people read the story in the book as it unfolded, because it is fascinating, because there were just so many different events and coincidences that I finally discovered that I did have more photographic documentation that I didn't even realize I had. And so I sent the first and the last picture from the close sighting, along with some footage of a 1998 sighting that I alerted some of the other videographers about, and we actually caught a 20-minute array, 40 miles wide, totally unlike March 13th, but nonetheless spectacular, of straight lines of these orbs and mirror images and a giant pyramid of three lights at the end. It was kind of a grand finale. It was pretty impressive. But as an afterthought, I sent the first and the last picture from the close sighting to Dr. Bruce McAbee, Navy optical physicist. And he comes back a couple of weeks later and he says, now you told me that close sighting in 95 was only a couple minutes or so. I said, right. He says, are you sure? I said, well, that's what I remember. What I just shared with your audience is what I remember of that sighting. I don't really even remember the last orb disappearing or going inside, and certainly didn't look at the clock and whatever. It's kind of fuzzy. But at any rate, he says, ask your husband. Now, interestingly, he wanted my husband to confirm the time. For me, that close sighting was wondrous and awesome, and just as many people throughout the state would describe on March 13th, they felt grateful and they were blessed to have seen the spectacular show. My husband didn't want to talk about it. He was very busy with the practice, and he was on several state and hospital medical boards at the time, and he just didn't want to deal with it at all. I mean, he really didn't want to talk about it, and I told Dr. McAbee that. He said, well, sit him down and confirm the time at any rate. So I did. And he confirmed it was like 3-4 minutes tops. And I went back to Dr. McAbee and told him that. He said, that's impossible. I said, what do you mean? He says, and then of course it's a visual, but look, you know, if you're looking at the pictures, you can see it straight on. Number one, the same phenomena, the same exact orbs in a line that I would capture 2 months before the mass sighting, head-on turning into a V, and during the mass sighting with the video of the 3 points of light that originally started out as 6 points of light, the same phenomena is in the same location in the 95 sighting as well, in the closed orbs. While we were so concentrated on the closed orbs, I never noticed any lights out in the distance, and they're disappearing too. So if you go back, because I relayed that some people said they saw these orbs detach from the main object, go out into the environment, and then redock with it. Maybe that's what happened in 95. I don't know. But nonetheless, he says that's one thing. He said the most significant thing is when you look at the skyline, there's many groups of lights that are on in the first picture that are off in the last picture. He said that doesn't happen in a couple of minutes. He says, I'd like you to do an experiment. He says, go out on the balcony, stand where you were approximately standing in 95, and take the skyline at night every hour, then the next night every half hour, and then the next night every 15 minutes, and we'll see when the lights start going out so we can evaluate what we're talking about in time-wise. Well, I usually take a bath between 7 and 8. In the evening when we're home. And so to be conservative, let's say 8 o'clock. And by the way, it was the night before my birthday, so it was a really cool coincidence then, too. Mm-hmm. It was a really cool gift. But anyway, if we start out at 8 o'clock, to be conservative, the first groups of lights start going out at 9, and the last picture is indicative of 10:30, 11 o'clock. And he asked me if he could present the case at the upcoming 1999 MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, symposium in Washington, D.C. Now, I had no idea what he was talking about. I would have never noticed this in a zillion years. And I just said to him, look, you know, whatever you think is appropriate, just keep my name out of it. I can't wrap my head around this. And he did, in 1999, presented the case at the MUFON International Symposium in Washington, D.C., as the first authenticated photographic evidence ever of missing time. Now, that's significant because there are no pictures of missing time, but I never told a soul. I never shared it. It's not even mentioned in my first book or the second edition, but when I was asked to tell about what has happened since I came forward from 7 years of anonymity in 2004, the publisher wanted me to write another book, and I said, that's not happening. Number one, it was one of the hardest things I've ever done, but it's really important that people read the first book. So I said I would, you know, add another chapter on similar sightings that have been happening worldwide, such as Stephenville sighting, and I learned that there was a mass sighting 1 month before ours in St. Petersburg, Russia, where a couple of people got video. In fact, one of the videos of this massive formation of lights, each light is made up of three lights in and of itself, is the craft that we have on the cover of the newest version of our documentary, The Phoenix Lights Beyond Top Secret, because it's the same thing. It was in St. Petersburg, Russia, a month before ours. This is happening worldwide, and other countries are much more open to these things being unearthly. But anyway, the reason that I'm sharing this information for the first time now is because, number one, I do not believe in coincidence anymore, and if I have the data, maybe it's important. If it could open the door, if science would really take a look at it, and if it could open the door not only to blow the concept of linear time off the map, that it's primitive, mm-hmm. the past, present, and future is not really what time really is, and also even more significant, I think, is that now that quantum physics and quantum mechanics is starting to catch up and talking about the bubble theory and string theory of the possibility of 10 or 11 different dimensions out
right.
there,
mm-hmm.
well, you know, this opens up a whole new window for us where if there's other times and spaces along with ours, then why is it such a leap to think that there might be other sentient, intelligent beings in those other times and spaces that we get glimpses of if we're open to them or invited? So I thought that, you know what, at this point in history, I couldn't have done this 5 years ago, but at this point, because quantum physics and our science is starting to catch up and actually be open to the possibility of other dimensions out there, that I think is really significant, really significant.
Mm-hmm. I remember.
And that's why I'm sharing it. Go ahead.
Okay. I remember in high school I had a science teacher who said the one thing that can never really be defined is time. And I always thought, you know, you might have had something there, still do. I want to talk about a couple of different things. First of all, for people who have not heard this story, I'd like to follow up on what Fife Symington did after the situation. He came forward. I want to talk a little bit about that. But also, one thing that comes to mind is there's not someone outside observing all the time, and I know that there were some sightings afterwards in the same valley, but, I mean, can you imagine how many times that craft in particular or another crafts that were sighted have come through there that people never saw? You know, I mean, we're only awake so many hours a day.
Right. No, absolutely. You're absolutely right on. I mean, I get reports. I have thousands and thousands of reports, not only from all over the world, and you know, it's so heartening to know that people appreciate the work that's gone into this, because I really tried to do my homework for everybody. And you know, once people look at it, they really appreciate not only the work that's gone into it, but the reality of this. And that yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, there have been sightings. You know, as I mentioned, the sunset pictures of these rods. I mean, there have been numerous sightings in other mountain ranges, Superstition Mountains and so forth, right here in the Phoenix area. And this is happening worldwide. It's not just Phoenix, okay? And the mass sighting was statewide. But people have seen these rods around the world, these cigar-shaped objects,
right.
Huge, massive, and call them mothership or whatever, with orbs or smaller ships, disks or whatever, coming out from these cigar-shaped things. So, you know, when you think of the different things that are happening worldwide, these triangles that have actually been with us, these V-shaped objects, probably before, but they were documented on film in the 50s in the Lubbock Lights, if you've ever heard of that, very similar to what we saw. In fact, before that time, in 1897, April of 1897, which is really interesting because it was almost exactly 100 years before us, in Kansas, California, Washington, and Canada, they were describing, thousands of people were describing this massive airship, in their words, this is before UFOs came into mm-hmm. to play, but massive airship with movable lights. Now, you know, when you go back and you listen to the descriptions of these orbs detaching from the main object and going out into the environment and redocking with it, this was happening in 1897, okay? And that's 6 years before the Wright brothers came out, you know, the first plane took flight. So what was that?
Hmm.
Okay, and even before that, I mean, we have drawings. I talked about petroglyphs on South Mountain, but there are drawings etched in primitive caves in Pakistan and Peru of long extinct animals with a UFO, what we would call a UFO in the sky. Why is that there? Why would they even do that unless they had seen something that they're illustrating? And certainly in Sumerian writings and India writings and even the Bible, these phenomena have been with us since human documentation began. That blew me away when I learned that. I mean, I had no idea. And certainly, you know, as we fast forward and we get to the World War II Foo Fighters, mm-hmm. I conferred with Dr. Richard Haynes, who is a PhD yes. psychologist who has studied very well respected, and he studied pilot sightings, thousands of pilot
right.
sightings,
uh-huh.
and particularly Foo Fighters in World War II. Every side thought that the other side had this advanced spy technology, these orbs. Mm-hmm. that were in rock-solid formation, twos and threes, that were flying around their planes. And it wasn't until after the war, Germany, Japan, and the United States tried to study these phenomena, and everybody learned that nobody had them.
Right.
you
yeah.
know, so they've been around for a long, long time. And, you know, besides the 80s and the 90s with, I think the 60s, actually, with Hudson Valley, New York, there was a big sighting there of the giant triangle craft, as well as UK and Belgium in
right.
the 90s, came to the United States and said, "Are you doing this?" And the United States flatly denied that we were. And they're a model, just as the media is a model here in Phoenix area. They're a model, Belgium is a model, for what should happen when there's anomalous sightings. They join forces with the military, the government, the university, and civilians to try to find an answer and study these phenomena. And that's what needs to happen. So I hope, you know, I hope with the internet, and by the way, the Phoenix Lights was the first mass sighting that had chat rooms on the internet. And yeah, we've certainly come a long way. I mean, I have to tell you too that when I first came forward in 2004, the official and accepted, except for the witnesses, of course, explanation of the Phoenix Lights was that it was merely illumination flares, military
right.
illumination flares. And that was it. I mean, that was it. And you can only imagine how frustrating it was for someone like myself that knew there was so much more to the story that the public wasn't aware of, and really prompted me to come forward. And as you said, you know, the more credible people that come forward, the more we can get this information out there in a credible way. And right after the 10th anniversary, the former governor, who had mocked the sighting in 97 by bringing out his aide with a giant alien head costume, and made a mockery of it, admitted that he actually saw it.
That's right.
And as a pilot and military, it was otherworldly, in his own words. And mm-hmm. that unless the military gave an explanation, which they never have, other than the flare thing, and I'll get back to that in a second, that it's alien. I mean, from another world. So that's number one, which is really a big step forward, I think, for an elected official to come forward and admit that he actually saw it. But on the other side, when they finally came out with the flare theory, and there's a whole story for that, because a month after the USA Today article came out, I get a call from the head of PR at the Air National Guard. Now, mind you, they had to come up with something, because the media was just frantic on, you know, and really, I mean, they deluged the state with questions. Why isn't there an explanation? Why isn't there an investigation? And once they talked to the witnesses, their descriptions were so detailed and so heartfelt, they really pressured. And in fact, Francis Barwood ran on a platform at the time, this is 3 years later, to become Secretary of State, on a platform to get answers for the Phoenix Lights. But anyway, let me go back for a second. So a month after the USA Today article came out, I get a call from the head of the PR at the Air National Guard, and she says, "Oh, Dr. Lynn, I think we know what those lights were back in March." And I said, "You do?" She said, "Oh, yeah, do you believe that nobody ever looked at the log for visiting Air National Guard?" This is 4.5 months later. And the Maryland Air National Guard was in town sending off flares in Operation Snowbird, which I came to learn from the military means diversionary tactical maneuvers, okay? So I have no doubt the flares may have been sent off, but that certainly isn't what thousands of people saw here. But at any rate, she said, "And that must be what some people saw."
Hmm.
And I said, "Well, when was the Maryland Air National Guard in town?" She said, "March 1st to the 15th. I said, "Were they in town in January?" She said, "Oh, no." I said, "Are you sure?" She said, "Absolutely." I said, "Well, I have 35 millimeter photographs of the same phenomena in the same location, confirmed by air traffic controllers 2 months before the mass sighting as being hovering over Class B restricted airspace, 1,000 feet altitude. And she said, "You never told me that."
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, and then I said, and by then I had educated myself, looking for a logical explanation. I had talked to every military base. I said, "And you're trying to say that flares that cannot keep a formation, that drift and drop with the wind, they have parachutes, they're just drifting haphazardly, and have huge smoke trails that are illuminated by the flare itself and illuminate, that's what they're for, to illuminate the area, not one. As I described earlier, the Phoenix lights, the light was self-contained. Okay, now one person described it. I said, "You're trying to say that flares that cannot keep a formation for more than a couple of minutes. I mean, they're immediately, falling and haphazard, traverse the entire state for hours in a rock solid, equidistant space V formation, a mile wide." And she says, "I have a call coming in. I'll get back to you." Well, I'm still waiting. It's almost 15 years later.
Wow. Getting back to what you said earlier, I think my personal opinion here is I think the difference between the Belgian government and the U.S. government is that the U.S. government knows a lot more and is keeping the lid on it.
Nobody knows why. It's a very good point. Nobody knows why. I mean, initially in the, in the 50s and whatever, when Project Blue Book came out, and you mentioned the condom report, which was a joke in itself, by the way. I mean, the University of Denver, in Colorado, condom report was really done by one man, condom. I mean, he supposedly, from what I've learned, didn't even really investigate it, and anything that was credible was brushed aside, just like Project Blue Book. So there's another report that was done in France a few years ago called the Cometa Report,
right. Uh-huh.
C-O-M-E-T-A, where they really get into the facts of these things and the fact that they are anomalous. So there are advanced anomalous aerial phenomena that are gracing our skies. There is no doubt about it, that are not from here. And even though most things can be explained, there are those that can't. And they address that. I mean, if anybody wants to read a very credible report, because they actually made that report because of national security, which is what, obviously, like you said, I mean, as much as they say that they're not studying this, somebody is, and somebody knows what's going on. And, in the 50s, it was because they didn't want, as Dr. Hynek said, to stir panic. I think now we've been so inundated for so many decades with the possibilities that we are being visited, and now with the internet, I mean, it's in real time. I have a couple of Facebook pages, and I urge anyone to join us, please, at Phoenix Lights Network, because I update things all the time with similar sightings worldwide and here as well. And I get posts from people in real time. They're seeing something at that moment and say, "Is anybody seeing this in Ohio or Nevada or Idaho or whatever?"
Really? Wow.
Which is very cool. I mean, that's cool. That's what should happen. We really need to get some kind of a central place, not just to report them, and certainly you can report them to MUFON and the National UFO Reporting Center. They're great resources, but there really needs to be a place where, when it's happening in real time, and I wish I had the capital to do this, but I don't. Mm-hmm. To make a center, a central place where there is sightings, and the internet is helping out on that, and Facebook as well, to where there is a sighting, that people alert other people right away so they can go out with their cameras and with their own eyes and take a look at it. I think that would be really cool.
Right. Now, we're just about out of time here. Do you ever think that you'll get back to your medical career, and has this actually hurt your chances to do that?
No, I was really surprised. It was very precarious for a medical doctor, particularly at that time. We've come a long way, I have to tell you. We have a lot more to go, but, you know, like I said, when I came forward, the official explanation was that it was flares, and now worldwide, because of the book, the documentary, and certainly many other people, including the councilwoman Barwood and the former governor coming forward, have gotten this out there and raised awareness worldwide that that something really spectacular and extraordinary happened here that, you know, again, I hope people really take a look at the facts, that when they have sightings worldwide that are similar, whether it's orbs or Vs, you know, giant V or triangle craft, they say, oh, look, there's the Phoenix Lights. That's really, really cool. I mean, that talk about being amazing and rewarding that people actually are becoming more and more aware of the Phoenix Lights event. In fact, Ann Strieber, Whitley Strieber's wife a couple years ago said something really endearing. She says, Lynn, she said, you've come such a long way. Phoenix Lights is now up there with Xerox and Kleenex. And I had to laugh because it's true. I mean, it's, you know, certainly there's many people out there that don't know about it yet, and I hope they find out about it. But it's one of the most credible, most documented mass sightings ever. And as far as my coming forward, I really tried to do my homework before I did. So that, mm-hmm. you know, look, it is what it is. And, you know, I'm not trying to convince anyone. It's the data. It speaks for itself. I just got it out there, and people really appreciate it. I had more doctors come up to me at the Arizona Heart Institute. I was really, really nervous because I didn't know what the reaction was going to be, and they would take me aside and say, oh, Dr. Kita, I have to tell you this. You know, I had a sighting when I was 7 years old on the beach in California or whatever it was, and so it really has been very rewarding. I've been very blessed that, you know, you always have your detractors that still say it was definitely flares or a blimp or whatever, mm-hmm. and I know they haven't looked at the data. You know, they're showing their own ignorance. That's their choice. But that's right. Or they can't deal with it, and that's their choice too, because everyone in their own time. But, you know, as far as going back to my medical career, I have to tell you, I hated leaving my wonderful job, chief clinical consultant at the Arizona Heart Institute, to complete the documentary. But I haven't looked back. And right now, actually, now that the book and the documentary have gotten lives of their own, I am going back to my passion of youth education and working on a curriculum called Out of the Box. And I'm working with some wonderful people, not only major people in the field, such as Colin Andrews and dealing with crop circles and senior math professor, the geometry of crop circles, and the history guideline with Richard Dolan and Dr. Bruce McAbee, and really want to get something out there that's fun and interesting, just an overview of the topic of unexplained phenomena. But there is nothing. That actually was what prompted me to do the documentary, because when I first came forward in 2004, I was working 7 to 7 at the Art Institute, doing Barnes & Noble and Border tours on the weekend and radio programs like this into the night. I had no time to do anything else. I was getting like 2 or 3 hours of sleep a night. And a couple of parents had seen me at a Barnes & Noble presentation and invited me, set it up at a middle school. And I come walking in, and there's 200 middle school students there. I was so thrilled that they would even let me come in and talk about this topic. And you could hear a pin drop. It was the last period of the day. The teachers couldn't believe it. These kids were on their edge of their chairs. They thirst for this knowledge. Sure. And I realized there is nothing. There is nothing. I'm talking nothing in our history books about this topic. So that really prompted me to do the documentary, which I had a couple of filmmakers approach me, and one was very persistent, Steve Lance, who was very talented, and his parents live here, and he said, I'm coming with my equipment in May, and we're doing this. And I said, wait a minute. I said, I have no time. Plus, I had stayed anonymous for 7 years. I didn't know if other people would want to come forward. People, you know, witnesses had contacted me by email confidentially, and I had met with these professors, and it's very, very precarious for professors. They can lose their grants if they talk about this topic at university level. But every single person I went to, except one who came on later, said that they would immediately. And that was another sign. And once we started in production, by June. I mean, one person can only do so much. And mm-hmm. Steve and I literally did the entire movie together, and we've won over a dozen International Film Festival Awards, which is so rewarding. But I couldn't have done it without the help of everyone that contributed to the documentary, the witnesses and the experts and the professors. It's really been an amazing, amazing journey. And, you know, I hope that people will pick up the book, The Phoenix Lights, The Skeptic's Discovery, That We Are Not Alone, and learn about that journey, because there is much more to the story. I actually found a connection between all unexplained phenomena, be it near-death experience, out-of-body, unexplained aerial phenomena that I talk about in the book. I actually call them all UPS, unexplained phenomena, UP and UP, for the very reason that not only is the experience similar, but the after effect of any of these unexplained phenomena experiences is so profound, life-changing, positive, and enlightenment and awakening that happens within an individual who truly experiences an UP, that I address that as well and talk about that in the book. So there's a lot in there mm-hmm. that people can learn and grow, just as I have. I mean, this has been a transformation and a learning curve for me too, because I knew nothing about this topic. So I urge people to just take a look at my book or others to just open your mind a little bit, your mind and your heart. That's the first step, and learn about it.
Well, you just mentioned children earlier, and you know, children are the one part of our society that is open-minded, you know, and
mm-hmm.
I think they birthed for this.
They love it.
That's right. Well, I'm going to link your website below this podcast, as well as the clip for the video of the documentary, and thank you so much. You've been absolutely wonderful.
Well, I so appreciate you inviting me, because this is what it's going to take. I can only do so much. It's going to really take the media and wonderful people like yourself to get the word out there, to let people know that this happened and that there's credible documentation for it, and, you know, to talk about it. It's really important that we talk about it. It's very healing. If people out there have had an experience, even if it can be explained, it's real to you. And I welcome people to get on the website, the Phoenix Lights Network, and contact me and share your own sighting. It's really important. It's very healing and cathartic to share, even with one person. Don't be afraid to contact me. It won't go any further. So I welcome that, and I really appreciate the time that we spent together today.
I do, too. So this is Martin Willis with Dr. Lynn Kitai, and that's it for today. Thank you.